Okay, so Patrick, thank you, and let me thank all the organizers for giving me the chance to participate in the workshop. I should have been here for a while now, for 4 weeks or so, and it was really inspiring for the work that I've been pursuing. And I will also tell you about some stuff that I did recently that links, of course, to the types of issues addressed in that workshop, being some new ways how to possibly think about frustrated magnetic systems, namely the pseudofermion functional RG. And this talk will be slightly method-oriented, and I haven't given that many talks on that method from this purely methodological point of view, but I think we'll hopefully manage to make you understand of what the basic concepts are. So I just changed my affiliation lately from Stanford to Lausanne. So even though a lot of people know where Lausanne is, let me still invest 20 seconds on that, how beautiful it is. So it's basically located at this nice Lake Geneva. And it's actually just right at the most northern part of this Lake Geneva, sort of centered Switzerland, or more westward Switzerland. And so frustrated magnetism has always been a core discipline in Lausanne, and maybe this methodological ansatz helps to continue along that path. Okay, let me first acknowledge the collaborators, before all, let me mention that this whole work originated from this fantastic work that Johannes Reuter started in his PhD, and we actually started collaborating when he was in his third year. Unfortunately, I haven't found any better picture of him. That's him in the somewhere, I think, like in the, somewhere in the mountains. He loves to hike. So that's basically all the work originated from Johannes' approach to apply FRG to frustrated magnetism. But then as we continued working together, a lot of other people helped us to understand further aspects of it and contributed to a couple of works that we have done lately. So there's one of our diploma students in Würzburg, like Suttner, and Dima Abanin. Many of you will know him, of course. And there's Philipp Gegenwart, an experimentalist on the that lately did fantastic work on these iridate compounds. Then Simon Trebs, well-known person here at KTP / Station Q. Then Christian Platz, a PhD student in Würzburg that is graduating, as well as Stefan Rachel, who's in Dresden right now, and Peter Wörfle, my former PhD advisor. And in the latest works, just to wrap this up in case anyone wants to have a look at it, I think the most notable works we did by now with using the method for certain paradigmatic frustrated magnetic models had been the anisotropic triangular lattice, the Heisenberg-Hanekamp model, the Heisenberg-Kitaev model, and the quantum spin Hall models, and how you can reconcile interesting physics there from a strong coupling point of view. And some details of these papers I'll try to go through in some sort of synopsis kind of picture. So the outline will be as this. So since I not only want to introduce that method as it is, but also how it fits into the framework of other approaches, let me give a very quick introduction to the general concepts that people have been dealing with when the task is to understand frustrated magnetism. And let me then continue by actually putting this particular FRG approach into the general notion of FRG approaches that, of course, have a history that basically date back to Ken Wilson when he came up with the whole idea of RG. And once we have familiarized ourselves with the context of the method and the details of it, I will go through certain type of physical models where we can sort of see some sort of case studies of the pseudofermion FRG. And two of them are published already, being the anisotropic triangular lattice and the honeycomb iridates. But also, if time allows, I will also elaborate a bit on the work that we have done recently on the Kagome-Heisenberg model. Okay. So approaches to frustrated magnetism, if we want to understand how complicated frustrated magnetism is, and of course hinting why RG might be a solution to that, of course you could start with what I would call the scaling problem. So we start with a Hamiltonian that on a microscopic scale has comparably large appreciable energy scales, such as some Heisenberg exchange coupling. So the microscopic connection of that scale actually tells us that the scale can be pretty big. And then we know that if we include quantum fluctuations and everything, conventional notions of magnetic order set in at some order of magnitude lower than these typical energy scales of the couplings that enter the microscopic Hamiltonian. But then the core idea and the core problem of frustrated magnetism is that because we have competing fluctuations, the actual energy scale at which physics is happening is basically reduced by orders of magnitude. So we are talking about physics that we are trying to connect from a high energy sort of ab initio point of view, if you want to say so, being some sort of Heisenberg model, for example, going down to low energies where the actual phenomena of frustrated magnetism take place. And this is, of course, a very challenging task. And one direction that people have been doing, and of course I won't go through that in a chronological way, but let me start with numerical calculations that basically take the microscopic bare Hamiltonian as a starting point and try to obtain exact results for finite size systems. And basically, of course, there had been adaptations to that, but this is the general idea. And there have been a lot of interesting and fantastic numerical approaches that have been developed, in particular in the last years. Particular development has been seen in the field of density matrix normalization group, in particular applied to two-dimensional systems. We've seen Hong Cheng Zhang is in the audience, Bela Bauer is in the audience, Steve White was part of the workshop. Basically, a lot of names that you see here have been participating in the workshop. Then, of course, the exact normalization method, with the top-notch system sizes going up to 40, impressive 48 sites by Andreas Leuchli that he told us about on the Kaganer lattice, also complement DMRG methods. Then we have variational quantum Monte Carlo ansatze, such as also recently pursued by Tarun and Brian, and various other methods. And in particular, maybe another very promising future direction is this MIRA type methods that also Guy Frévidal gave a very impressive talk on in the conference of this workshop. So just to give you an idea, so there are two things why I'm showing this plot. First of all, I've been sharing my office with Timothy Zimmern for 4 weeks, so I sort of wanted to show some work of his. And also it's telling you that this is an exact normalization result from 1992, where for the first time they did 4x4 and 6x6 finite size scaling. So it basically gives you an idea that actually this direction of numerical calculations is not that old, because computers simply weren't that capable in earlier days. So still, on the other hand, you see the dichotomy here. I mean, they could do 4x4 and 6x6. If we now ask ourselves how much can we do now, I mean, we have a couple of sites more, but at the same time it's also showing us how challenging it is to fight the exponentially increasing basis of finite size systems. So the major challenges, I would say, to wrap up the really promising direction of numerical calculations could be summarized as system size, really fixing where the phase transitions are in some manifold of possible magnetic phases or magnetically ordered and disordered phases, finite temperature aspects, and related to that, dynamic response. So I think those issues are very hard to treat, and there are promising approaches, but still I think those are the main challenges. So another direction that had been performed, of course, that is always performed in any type of physical problem that we're looking at. We're always happy when we have exact models at hand, or at least wave functions that elucidate a certain property of new effective excitations that we're dealing with. And of course, maybe by now the most famous exactly solvable model in the frustrated magnetism community is the spin liquid models by Alex Kitayev. Here I show you the honeycomb Kitayev model that he published in 2006. But let me also remind you of this very long-standing and old direction of writing down wave functions to really guide our intuition of what the actual quantum numbers of the states are and the excitations thereof. And this dates back to Bob Laughlin's work in 1987, where he, inspired by his idea about quantum Hall systems, wrote down the Kara-spin liquid wave function, which is written here. So you see, you can just write a Hartke boson formulation of a spin 1/2 system, and then written in these Hartle bosons, basically the Kairos-Pilnik wave function looks exactly like a bosonic Laughlin state at 1 over 2, and then it has been, we try to find exact Hamiltonians for this type of problems and also generalize that to PT invariant systems, but I won't talk too much about this here. But another exciting point where these exact wave function approaches start to merge with diagonalization ansätze and DMRG methods is this nice talk by Bela Bauer that he gave us lately, actually yesterday or the day before, on how to actually possibly realize this Kairos-Pilnik liquid state employing a chirality Hamiltonian on the Kagome lattice. Okay. So then what are we left with? Probably the most successful and the most stimulating perspective on phosphoretic magnetism, namely slave particle mean field theories and the careful analysis of gauge theories following from there. Of course, when one writes a slide like this, I mean, it's impossible to mention all the people that contributed to this. And in particular, I'm just emphasizing what the mean field theory perspective on it is. If one asks who really went on and basically continued to understand the gauge theory from a more fundamental point of view, of course, amazing works have been done by many other people also in the audience, such as Patrick Sentil was here, Matthew Fisher, and many other people. So for the talk, all I want to talk about is just the basic idea of what mean field theories are that we write down for frustrated magnets. And the basic idea is that either we represent the spin-type Hamiltonian by bosons, we can do that quite conveniently, and in particular when we wanted to describe order, then we know already that since the magnons sort of share the quantum numbers of the bosons that we write down, it's a very convenient way to compute properties of ordered phases within bosonic mean field approaches. And of course, when we write down the spin Hamiltonian as a bosonic operator form, we need some constraint, as also Cenk talked about, and everyone talks about in this context, that of course constrains the number of bosons to match, if we constrain ourselves to spin 1/2, it would to match 1 or the according number of particles. So this as a whole can be also employed for spin liquids, but I think it's fair to say that a more preferable approach to spin liquid type of phases, to magnetically disordered phases, has been put forward by slave fermion mean field theories. Why is that? I mean, first of all, I think it's quite clear that any type of mean field formulation that is a bit off the actual the microscopic system has the larger propensity to Bose condense and hence form order in a bosonic formalism than it does in a fermionic formalism. So second is, of course, that intertwined with this recent, with the promising approaches to high-TC superconductivity put forward by Anderson in 87, people really realized that it's probably a very promising direction to also look into spin-type systems from a slave fermion perspective, and of course previous works even date back to Aprikosov in 64. And here, this looks very similar to the slave boson approaches. Here we just represent the spin operator by fermionic bilinear, and at the same time we also get, and this is for the specific case spin 1/2, we get a single occupancy constraint that we have to deal with. Of course, now we have to realize the following thing. If we start with a Hamiltonian of some Heisenberg form, if we do this mean field ansatz, of course we get a very complicated, strongly coupled gauge theory. And this, of course, has been at the heart of research in the last 20 years. And this is also why this field is so interesting, but at the same time also so hard to reach really, you know, ultimate conclusions on certain phases. And this is where I think our RG can set in. And this is where I want to start. So our randomization group perspective builds up on the slave fermion approaches and asks the following question. So imagine we have this Hamiltonian. So take some Heisenberg term. So what we would do in slave fermion approaches is we would make a mean field theory out of this. We obtain a gauge field, and then we would include, a posteriori, we would try to include the gauge fluctuations into the mean field solution and see whether the mean field state is a reasonable state. I sort of want to commute these two approaches and want to say, first of all, what we do is we start with a microscopic system, we integrate out higher energy modes, and then we would end up with an effective theory which we could then solve in mean field. So in a way, you could think of our RG approach as propagating sort of a commuted version of what is usually done in slave fermion slash gauge theory model approaches to frustrated magnetism. And of course, this has an enormous advantage. It says that we can start from a microscopic Hamiltonian and carefully consider the parameter tendencies at the level of the microscopic Hamiltonian. This is always the problem with the mean field approach. I mean, you can get interesting states and be very inventive and guided by intuition and write down interesting states, which you can even prove for self-consistency. But the main question you probably might not be able to answer always, namely saying, I vary the second neighbor Heisenberg coupling by 10%, will this state still be stable? Or what type of phase transition will there be? What type of amount of J2 do I need to drive whatever phase transition? In turn, this is the core question that we are asked by experiments. I mean, we can sort of fit some high temperature values for this ab initio model here, but then the experimentalists would like from us to say, okay, you should see this type of phase. And this is usually quite hard to do. And I think that's where the RG method can provide some additional tool. So let me come to the functional RG ansatz, what this is about. And since this is supposed to be a partly methodological talk, please allow me two more technical slides, which you don't have to follow in case you just want to get the basic ideas, but whoever wants to get into what we're actually doing, these slides are needed. So let's consider a two-body interaction fermionic action, something like this. So we have the Grassmann fields, we have some non-irritating term, and the K prime and K denote some sort of quantum numbers. I didn't want to specify that because, you know, sometimes it's easier to rewrite the theory in a local way. Sometimes it's more convenient to rewrite it in a random way. So this is just the quantum number by which the theory is characterized, so basically either real space or momentum. And then of course we have the interaction term, dependent on the Grassmann fields. Now, the next step is we need to write down the generating functional for the one particle irreducible vertices. This is not a big deal. So basically what you do is you basically have, first you introduce the source fields to generate the m-particle Green's functions, then you amputate the outer legs of the Green's functions, and then you perform a Legendre transform such that the fundamental fields of your system basically are linked to generating one particle irreducible vertices. So that's one step, and then once you have obtained that, you expand this into these m particle vertex functions. So this is nothing else but some m particle scattering functions that you would be familiar with. Like, this is sort of the jargon of this community. So the first statement is that once we have this generating functional, we expand into these m particle vertex functions. So this is one series that we consider. The next series we consider is the FRG series that we need to make a comparison of coefficients. And what we do is the following. Instead of starting with the Green's function without any type of further information into it, we introduce a cutoff parameter to the Green's function. And this could be of some sort, so I wrote this as kappa, so the cutoff is lambda, and the cutoff could be either done in frequencies, sometimes it's done in momentum, that depends on the actual system that you're looking at. But the core idea is, you do this replacement in the action, in the fermionic action, and then in addition to expanding the one particle irreducible vertex functional into these m particle vertex functions, you also expand the functional in derivatives of lambda. Okay, so those are the two series that you compute. You compute the series in terms of derivatives of lambda, and you compute the series in terms of one particle irreducible vertices. And then you make a comparison of coefficients, and what you end up with basically are the flow equations that are the starting point of the functional RG. So unfortunately, Joseph Polchinski is not here, but let me say that this actual approach, building up on earlier ideas of Wilson, is due to Polchinski, which was then carried over by Wetterich to high energy physics, and I think the first notable paper along with, I forgot Claude Bourbonnais from from Sherbrooke. But aside from that, I think a very noticeable paper is by Ramamurthy Shankar, who wrote A Review of Modern Physics in 94 on that approach. So feel free to look into that if you want to see more. But just let me guide you through what the eventual model is that we're studying in FRG. So in FRG, what you end up from these comparison of coefficients that I showed you, you basically get an evolution of the single particle vertex, the two particle vertex, and so on, as a function or as it changes with the lambda, with this cutoff that you impose on the Green's function. And what you can see from the structure of these equations is that the change of the m particle vertex function, or interjectively I call it Green's function, it just depends on whether you have amputated legs or not, that doesn't change the physics, essentially. So whether the change, it's always such that the m particle vertex function and the change with respect to lambda depends on the m plus 1 particle vertex function. So as you can see here, the change of the single particle propagator is links to a term which looks like a self-energy term that builds up on the two particle vertex function. And then if we look at the change of the two particle vertex function, then this depends on some self-coupled terms of the two particle vertex function, which are essentially the parquet channels, the parquet RG, and some change, some self-energy diagram of the three-particle vertex. And of course, this would go on and on. I mean, by now there's no approximation. This is exact, okay? So far, what I told you is exact. So this would go on like this. So the change of the m, the change of the three-particle vertex would link to diagrams that link to the four-particle vertex, and so on and so forth. And just in case you're seeing this propagator with a dash, I mean, the derivative with respect to lambda has to appear somewhere on the right-hand side. So whenever you see this closed propagator, then this is a derivative with respect to lambda imposed on the Green's function. So this is called single scale propagator, because if you do a hard cutoff function, a Heaviside step function, then a derivative of the Heaviside step function would give you a delta function. So basically, then the derivative of this Green's function would live on a single scale. This is why the jargon is that this is called the single scale propagator. But of course, let me just, aside from these technical details, let me show you how powerful this method is. By now, we haven't done any approximation. And the interesting thing is, of course, now the following. When we start with some ab initio model, some ab initio ansatz, then usually we have a two-body interaction and maybe some single particle band structure. Let me just be very general, not even particularly alluding to frustrated magnetism. We can put all this as initial conditions to this set of differential equations, and then just solve these differential equations to obtain a low energy theory as the system flows along the cutoff. So we start with a cutoff that is far in the UV limit of the method, and then as we start the differential equations, basically the cutoff comes down and gives rise to effectively integrating out high energy modes and providing us with a low energy theory of this problem. So, and I believe this is very explicit and transparent idea of how this works. So, So in principle, I think this is sort of clear. So at the end of the day, what we do is we start with some information of the system. We compute the single particle vertex as a function of lambda. This is why it's called functional RG, because we don't just have the finite set of coupling constants. We're looking at the evolution of a whole function under RG. That's why it's called FRG. And we, at the same time, we in principle, we could look at the evolution of any m particle vertex function. And that's the thing that we want to pursue. Since probably this is the first time that you heard about this method, this slide might be needed. So let me give you a family tree of FRG. So I think it all started with Wilson. And as I said before, Polchinski was the first to really set up the formalism for it. And then I think it sort of bifurcated into high energy physics, which was sort of led by Christoph Wetterich in 1993, something like this, and by Ramamurthy Shankar in 1994. The true interest into FRG, to my point of view, maybe it's slightly biased, came along when people realized that we can understand Fermi surface instability with an unprecedented precision. And that happened around 2000, when Heinz Schulz started that with Sanchi. And at the same time, Maurice Reiss investigated this with Carsten Honerkamp and Manfred Salmhofer, as well as Walter Metzler, who independently developed this FRG ansatz. for this type of systems. And then other approaches to condo-type physics and others, and one-dimensional physics has been particularly put forward by Kurt Schönhammer and Volker Meden. So just let me restate this joke by Shivaji Sondhi. Like, in view of this last line of people, he always tends to say that FRG doesn't mean functional RG, it means Federal Republic of Germany, because all these people are basically German. Yeah, anyway. So once we have this family tree of FRG, then the degrees of freedom for the Green's function notation can of course change. If we're dealing with Fermi surface instabilities, a convenient way to start with the fermionic action is in momentum space. When we talk about slate fermion Hamiltonians, then of course it will be a real space picture. Then the truncation of this infinite hierarchy of differential equations, of course, has to be specified. How do we truncate it? We can't solve all of them. So there must be some approximation somewhere. I won't hide it from you, I will tell you. And then the cutoff can either be performed in momentum or in frequency. For the system that we'll be looking into, it will be done in frequency. So there has been a lot of interesting work and further development lately on the recoupling side of FRG, and maybe let me mention the works by Donghai Li and Fa Wang and ours for the arnictides and also for other unconventional superconductors. But of course now this was done in momentum space and some momentum cutoff. But now what we'll be talking about in the rest of the talk is the strong coupling pseudofermion RG, which we put forward lately, which basically lives in real space frequency space. Okay, so then let me be explicit and what we are talking about here. So now you see that the scale is not temperature anymore, it's the cutoff now. So we start with a cutoff very high up in energy, above any coupling, above any ab initio energy scale of the problem. And then our starting point will be a single particle Green's function that is local. So that's essentially what this is, assigned with a Heaviside step function. Now, in case we do a mean field ansatz for the time-like gauge fluctuations, so let me emphasize that. If we make the ansatz for a constant density, then even this chemical potential would be gone. So because we're at half filling, so because of particle hole symmetry, this mu would have to be chosen to be zero. So this is sort of the most trivial Green's function that you can write down. It's simply an electron sitting somewhere which doesn't move. And of course, this is a highly degenerate starting state to begin with. I mean, at high energies, every electron sits on a single site, we're constrained to half filling, and it's highly degenerate because the spin can point in any direction. Essentially. And of course, this only holds until we are reaching the energy scale of the coupling between the spins, which now is the initial interactions for the two-particle vertex, which I, in allusion to scattering vertices, I would call gamma. So these are the incoming particles, these are the outgoing particles. And this is just one of the two terms that you need to rewrite the Heisenberg term in order to be antisymmetrized and so on and so forth. So that's the initial starting point of the method. So now, in this idea, what is happening as we start to integrate out modes? And the core idea is simply that as soon as you integrate out high energy modes, you're actually piling up a self-energy term in the single slave particle operator. And this, of course, as you have seen in at each infinitesimal step, we pile up a change of the single particle propagator. This single particle propagator, of course, appears again in the diagrams that you sum up for the change of the two-particle vertex at the next infinitesimal step. So as you can see, this is beyond perturbation theory. That's a self-consistent resumation theory, because the propagator, the single particle propagator, dynamically changes along the RG flow.
Ronnie, can I ask a naive question? I mean, usually when I consider standard RGs and my lambda is determined by the log of the bandwidth with respect to the Fermi energy. Yeah. And this is what defines when my flow will break down. So in this regard, how do you know in this case when I should break, when I cannot trust in your sense of my RG?
So let me show you what conventional RG really does. Okay. Conventional FRG for Fermi surface instabilities ignores this equation. It ignores this term, okay? So basically, this term is ignored, this term is ignored. So there, you don't have a self-consistent resumation theory because your non-interacting propagator stays the same all the time. And of course, then, we're no magicians, okay? So of course, then, in this case, you need a small parameter to expand about. And this usually in this Fermi surface type RGs is the ratio of the interaction scale over the bandwidth. The key point here is, and I'm getting later to it, where we believe our method is valid and when it gets problematic, the core point here is that we are beyond perturbation theory. It's truly different because at each infinitesimal step, we're changing the propagator. And for example, if you think of RPA methods that have this type of, there are some kind of adaptions to that, there you can similarly see that as soon as you come up with self-consistent resonation theories, you can well exceed a small expansion parameter limit. But I'll come to this later.
So you still need a rational for truncation? So you truncate one loop, two loops, you have a small parameter which dictates that it's okay, or having two loops is smaller and like 1/n?
Give me one more slide.
Okay.
This I can answer already. So if you do large S expansions, if you do large N expansions, both subset of diagrams are completely kept in this method. Both of them. They are subsets of the diagrams. So just if you want to have a more intuitive picture of what we keep, the first thing that we keep is all 1/S diagrams and all 1/N diagrams. So the disordering tendencies and the ordering tendencies, if you want to say so, are treated on an equal footing. Basically because we admix at each infinitesimal step of the cutoff, we are admixing vertex corrections between the direct particle hole channel and the indirect particle hole channel. That's the core advantage of that method. I'll come to this later. So just to finish this, so what the low energy theory will look like that we obtain from this ansatz is some Green's function of the electrons which now has acquired some finite lifetime, which is still slave, which is still local, but then of course we have the two particle vertex which is the effective low energy theory at some given lambda. And this theory we would then analyze. Okay? So that's sort of, you could do all your mean field approaches. Instead of starting from high cutoffs, you could start at low cutoffs. And there you already have a guided idea of what type of fluctuations are important and what are not.
And Ronnie, another question, how do you then treat the constraints that you have for pseudo-fermions?
Okay, there are two ways to treat that. This is a different level of detailedness, so I try to avoid this here. But if you want to do this, one viable way is to do a mean field ansatz for the time-like gauge fluctuations, which would say that instead of having spatially dependent Lagrange parameters, we would assume to expand this around the mean of this Lagrange parameter. Since we're at half filling, this Lagrange parameter would induce a chemical potential effectively, which is at zero, so you can completely forget about this. This would be a mean field treatment. We have checked that carefully because we're able to also do the exact ansatz by employing Popov-Fedotov. So Popov-Fedotov ansatz will give you an imaginary chemical potential that manages to destructively interfere the W occupied state and the empty state of your partition function. So we have two ways to implement this ansatz. One will keep the single occupancy constraint exactly, the other one will keep it at a mean field level, but we can always consistently check whether this ansatz is justified or not.
And technically what you do, you check on each step of the FRG whether this is...
Yes, I mean, as an aside, from many other fields of frustrated magnetism, you know that the least problem to worry about are these time-like gauge fluctuations. They are not the problem. The spatial fluctuations are actually contained in the physics. So in most of the approaches that have been put forward, I think it's fair to say that the time-like fluctuations are the one to least worry about. So let me just summarize what the sort of recipe is that we put forward. The first thing is, again, this is just a different way of plotting these differential equations that we solve. So let me just comment on Madame Pétain's question here. So we basically stop the hierarchy of differential equations at the point where we're computing the two-particle vertex function. And then, of course, you're asking, okay, this differential equations don't close because we still have the three particle vertex entering the two particle vertex. So we need to do some, we need to have some idea to make this close. And this is the main approximation of the method. The main approximation of the method is not to throw this away or something, but to reduce this term to the two particle reducible aspects of the three particle vertex self energy. And this is some suggestion that had been put forward in 2004 by Andrei Catani. And we're still working on analytically solvable models, but that's work in progress, to really give you a more rigorous idea of what this approximation does. What André could show already is that the violation of word identities get largely reduced. So, of course, this is not a perfectly conserving approximation like Cardanov-Bain. So you're always dealing with this problem here, because the diagrammatic summations don't perfectly respect the word identities. But what you can show is that by replacing this term by this two-particle reducible term, which we can then compute from the knowledge of this quantity and this quantity, so which makes the set of differential equations close, you know, we can already get as far as possible without employing functional parametrizations and so on, which is another direction that, for example, Manfred Zahnhofer is pursuing. So this is as far as we can.
Is it so difficult to impose the world identities? You seem to.
Oh, so in order to impose. This is tough because, you know, in principle, in this formalism, you would need diagrams that are non-two-particle reducible. And as soon as you have that, you would need the full knowledge and the full RG flow of the three-particle vertex. So you don't want to keep that, because the three-particle vertex will have five frequency dependencies and two or three spatial indices. So there are just way too many arguments in this function. So you want to reduce the amount of differential equations you have to solve, and it's presently, I would say, except of particular models, it's totally out of reach to go that far. But a core idea I think that we are pursuing at the moment, and that I think is the most helpful one to even further improve the method, I don't think it needs much improvement. You'll see that in the really, I would say, comparably impressive results that we get from it. But a true improvement will probably be some smart functional parametrization of the terms that we're leaving behind by doing this replacement. There's some idea that I'm currently pursuing on that, but it's not yet finished. Okay? But so this is the main approximation of the problem. So in the simplest implementation of the model, there are two approximations: constant single occupancy constraint, which would remove the time-like gauge fluctuations. Second, replacing that three-particle vertex self-energy by all the diagrams contained in there, which are two-particle reducible. Those are the only two approximations that enter. And of course, then, in the end of the day, what we by now just computed, actually, we are currently building up on doing the mean field analysis that people have been put forward, because we have this now at low energy, so we can go on and actually do the standard mean field decompositions. By now, what we did is we computed the magnetic susceptibility for the given system, and from there, read off interesting properties. And this is just done by taking the two-particle vertex and contracting it. That's essentially what the spin-spin correlation function is. So maybe that's a good time to ask questions. So we have 36 minutes past. I think I need 10 minutes for the results. So maybe I'll just show you some results, and then we discuss about the method afterwards. So let me first show you some results on the anisotropic triangular lattice. So unfortunately, Leon is not here. So the anisotropic triangular lattice received a lot of attention from different perspectives. Let me not invest too much time here. For now, let me just make you understand what the model is that I'm talking about. So I'm talking about a system which has hybridization anisotropy on the lattice, and from there in the strong coupling picture, an anisotropy between the couplings along these two lines and the horizontal line. So the horizontal line has a different prefactor, and the prefactor is psi in reference to the other two lines, which are 1. And of course, when we would put this term to 0, then we would be on the square lattice. When we put it to 1, we're on the triangular lattice. And when we put it to infinity, we have basically uncoupled 1D chains. If you, just to guide your intuition about what you should see in the magnetic susceptibility is, if you now ask, okay, I have some ordered phase, and how does that link to the magnetic susceptibility profile in momentum space, this is how it would look like in the extended zone scheme. So we don't fold back, because the actual physical experiment would show you the extended zone. It wouldn't show you the folded zone. So we wanted to keep as close to experiment as possible. So the antiferromagnet in this notation would be located as a peak in the center of this upper boundary of the Brillouin zone. Then we have 100-degree nail order, two independent peaks at the corners, and then collinear antiferromagnetic fluctuations, which would show up along these midpoints of these zone boundaries. And just try to keep that in mind. Antiferromagnet is up here, nail order is at the corners, and collinear antiferromagnet is around here. So let's see what we get. And let's actually start with the square lattice. And what I'm showing you here are the magnetic susceptibility plots that we obtained from the method. And we can go to larger system sizes than any other numerical method. So we can go to 300 sides for the obvious reasons that the single particle, that the two particle vertex only depends on one spatial coordinate when you have translation invariance. You have I minus J. So actually, it's not that costly for us to increase system size, which is another appreciable aspect of the method. So this is what you see. So you have the magnetic susceptibility here at the square lattice point, and now we are turning on the anisotropy degree, and as you can see, the peak gets broader and broader and eventually splits into two independent peaks, which are the predecessors of the 100 degree nail order. And you can see how beautifully you can resolve it in this methodological ansatz, because we can go to 200 sides or something and get a very fine resolution of what happens in the magnetic susceptibility. Let me just mention one little thing here. You know that the classical phase diagram would assume a phase transition at 0.5 in this model between antiferromagnet and 100 degree nail order. What we can see here is that you see that the single peak persists longer, and this is in accordance with many other methods. You see that quantum fluctuations actually manage to make the antiferromagnet persist longer than the 100 degree nail order. And then if you wanted to see, okay, so what do you see in your flow picture, you know, when you see some onset of order, we basically see some divergence of the vertices. So we can specify the channel that we're looking at, we can decompose the channel into different ordering channels, and what we see here is that the ordering channel in the nail sector diverges, mimicking the fact that we're getting an antiferromagnet here. So those are the, this is how these plots look like everywhere. And then when we eventually reach the I forgot that I'm talking about this. Yeah, okay, good. So when we reach the isotropic triangular point, you see that now the 100 degree nail order is the one that diverges. So we see, first of all, of course, the beautiful, nice 120 peaks, but also on top of that, this is how the flow picture would look like. And you see also that the cutoff scale at which it diverges is smaller, which is totally consistent with saying that, of course, the quantum fluctuations would way more reduce the 120 degree nail order than it does with a pi-pi antiferromagnet. So now, what had been most interesting in this type of problem lately is basically due to a statement by Leon Balance and Oleg Starek in 2007. They said that starting from the weakly coupled limit of one-dimensional chains, you can actually obtain this, the collinear antiferromagnetic fluctuations as the leading fluctuations in the system. Why is that interesting? It's interesting because the classical model wouldn't know about it. So there's no classical analog for collinear antiferromagnetic fluctuations in the anisotropic triangular lattice. So this actually choosing a different fluctuation channel due to quantum fluctuations, it's quite rare in frustrated magnetism. Usually it reduces the channel that we have from classical limits, or we go into a magnetically disordered phase, but actually flipping the dominant fluctuation channel is something that is quite interesting. So this is why I believe this paper by Leon was extremely fundamental and important, and I want to show that we see that. We see that mechanism. So as we crank up the anisotropy, you see that, first of all, let me tell you, we would have to show you that there's no divergence anymore, so the order is gone, there's no order. But at the same time, when we ask what are the dominant fluctuation channels that remain, and what we see is that there are some small peaks left over at the collinear antiferromagnetic points, which is exactly mimicking the statement that Leon and Oleg did in 2007. Okay. And please let me know later, in case you're interested. I just want to go through the results. So, of course, a lot of excitement also in this workshop had been produced by the Heisenberg or Kitaev Heisenberg model on the honeycomb iridates. Maybe let me be a. Sorry.
Can I go back? Oh, triangular lattice. So here you were studying from the type 0 to 1. there are some previous studies so that you might be in an intermediate phase.
Yeah, we haven't. We comment on that in our paper, and we haven't seen that.
Yeah, we can see. Okay.
We haven't seen it. We see order.
I see. It's consistent with German results.
Good. So then, one person less that would complain about it. Yeah, okay, so let me come to the Heisenberg-Kitaev model, and maybe let me be brief because we all learned about this in great detail in this workshop, and it was put forward by marvelous works by George Jacquelli and Geniad Kalirlin and their student Jerzy Szalupka. Basically, when you have some iridium, so and we have a five-valence system, you can think of the T2G due to spin orbit being split into a quartet that is filled and to a half-filled a doublet, so basically an effective spin 1/2, and from there they could argue that this is the preferred Hamiltonian, which sort of interpolates between an isotropic Heisenberg term and a maximally anisotropic Kitaev term. Exactly. So this is what we obtain. So we start in the isotropic only limit. So we get, again, I'm showing you here. So this is the antiferromagnetic phase on the honeycomb. On the honeycomb, the antiferromagnet would show up at the corners here. So this is the antiferromagnetic state. Then as we crank up alpha, you see how this antiferromagnetic order melts and merges into this stripe antiferromagnet that was also predicted by Kalirlin and Jacquelli. We see that how that happens here, but then most importantly, probably for you, is to see how we enter the Kitaev phase. So we observe the absence of order from point 8. So from point 8 of alpha, of this alpha parameter interpolating between the Heisenberg term and the Kitaev term, we see the vanishing of order, and then in the perfect Kitaev limit, we see this type of magnetic susceptibility. And at the beginning, we were sort of trying to understand what we got there, but this is exactly what you would expect, because in the Kitaev model, the only spin correlations that are finite are the nearest neighbor spin correlations. Now, if you fully transform a nearest neighbor spin correlation, it's exactly a cosine that you obtain, and this is exactly what that is. So we exactly produce what the Kitaev model has, but the strength now you see in the methods, of course, you can detect in detail how this magnetic susceptibility profile evolves from one ordered phase into the disordered phase, and what the magnetic signatures would be when you're in proximity to a Kitaev phase, and maybe not necessarily right at there. Yeah, I find this quite impressive. So then what this method can do. So then we further pursued this, and of course, if we can interpret the cutoff as a finite temperature, we can also obtain a Curie-Weiss law from the evolution of our vertices, which is what we did. And the core idea is, of course, that we would say that since the Kitaev term enters ferromagnetically, as we enhance alpha, of course, the Curie-Weiss temperature eventually will change sign, and we'll move from the antiferromagnetic side to the ferromagnetic side. That's not a super non-trivial statement. You can get this from any high temperature expansion. But now, combined with this statement, it becomes a strong statement. Namely, that we can sort of think of this typical mean field scale of the onset of vertex divergences that we get as a measure sort of the strength of the order. So when we do this as a function of alpha, we see that in the near phase, it linearly drops, but then in the stripy antiferromagnetic phase, it stays more or less constant. And that led us to the following conclusion. We have sodium iridate and lithium iridate. Sodium and lithium iridate, basically what they will change is the relevance of the spin orbit mediated exchange coupling, because the lithium leads to less quenching of the lattice because it's more electronegative than the sodium. Now, when this happens, we would assume that the near temperature might not change at all in the system, but the Curie-Weiss temperature might change. Imagine you're here, so then you have some near temperature fixed here by this ordering scale, and then you're shifting alpha. Once you're shifting alpha, then the Curie-Weiss temperature should, of course, change a lot, as you've seen in the last plot. And this is exactly what is found in experiments. Yeah.
If you just go back a slide. So what do you mean by calling this line semi-classical? I mean, I guess you can get the Curie, as the first order high temperature expansion, you can get the Curie-Weiss temperature exactly from the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by semi-classical?
So what we mean is, you can basically that's what we mean by semi-classical. Maybe it's an inappropriate wording here, but this is exactly what we're saying. I just wanted to stress that it's not exactly the same, but basically you see that the features are not that different, and it's sort of clear because the Curie-Weiss temperature is a high temperature property of the system, so there should be a lot of methods at hand to obtain it.
Mm-hmm. So probably you get a difference because you're fitting it at some finite
frequency. And we have finite frequency discretizations and all this stuff. So I wouldn't assign physics into the discrepancy.
Sorry, I have a question, very basic question about the Dive model. The Kedive phase is a superconducting phase of spinons.
Mm-hmm.
So when you approach this phase transition between the Kedive and the Kedive boundary, shouldn't you expect some susceptibility to diverge of some? I mean, if it is really capturing everything correctly about the Kedive phase, then you should see divergence of some susceptibility.
Oh, well, that depends on. No, wait a second. I mean, basically, what you should see is. You should only in this method you should only see the divergences that link to the symmetry breaking, that links to the actual vertex that you have written down in the degrees of freedom that you have written down. I agree with you. If we now, and we're doing this at the moment, we take the low energy theory, and then we ask, then we do the decomposition as you would do that, starting from the gamma at low energies, and then you're asking, do you have a tendency to form a superconducting phase of spinors and so on? This will be an onset analysis. I don't think that this divergence should show up here.
I mean, like any other phase you are describing, something is diverging. That's how you detect any phase transition. So there is a phase transition here. If you're imposing, say, f dagger f is equal to 1 exactly, so if it's purely spin model, then you should definitely see such spin susceptibility, f dagger Cooper pair susceptibility should diverge.
Oh, I agree with you, but this would not be. It's definitely worth looking into this. I'm just saying this is not in contradiction with what I'm showing you here.
But I'm saying.
I agree. It's interesting.
That it allows to.
Yes.
To explore.
We haven't followed up on this too much. By now, we have mainly solely computed the susceptibilities, the spin susceptibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely exactly the right question to ask, and that's what we're doing as well. But let me just finish this statement. So we had this argument in our paper that we were saying, okay, if you replace sodium by lithium, then the nail temperature might stay the same, but the Curie-Weiss temperature might actually change by an order of magnitude. And this is exactly what was found by Philipp Gegenwart, going from sodium iridate to lithium iridate. But on top of that, there was a big problem, of course. It was no striped antiferromagnet was found, but a zigzag antiferromagnet was found. So how can we reconcile that? So we continued our work with Philip. So out of the discussion emerged the collaboration, and we were thinking, we were trying to remind ourselves how we could possibly get a collinear antiferromagnet on the honeycomb lattice, and then we went back to some work that we did with Dima, and there's also a paper at the same time, a similar related time by Andreas Leuchli from Exact Organization, and of course, I mean, previous works as well. So maybe our idea was maybe the explanation would be that there's finite J2 and finite J3 coupling in these iridates that would explain the absence of striped antiferromagnetism and the presence of 15, yeah, okay. So maybe we could explain that. So then let me skip the Kagome results, and I'm happy to talk to you about it in case you want to hear more. And thank you for your attention.
So, how do you treat Gates transition in this method? So there is you haven't mentioned any.
No, because we don't need to. You see, you never enter the mean field description and then are in need of treating gauge fluctuation separately. We don't do the mean field decoupling. You see, we have a quadrilinear. All the fluctuations are kept. All the spatial gauge fluctuations are kept in complete accuracy.
So, okay, can you do some temperature dependent measurement in your method, like the specific heat?
Oh, so essentially, in a way, this is sort of what specific heat?
Right, specific heat or some substituted temperature dependence. And so,
yeah,
how is the setting of this
So by now we've constrained ourselves to the magnetic susceptibility, and you know the information that we have. The information that we have is the two-particle vertex, where the individual particles are the slave fermions. But let me state this again. We keep all gauge fluctuations. And this is the core advantage of this method over all the other methods that have been proposed here. We are not entering the problem of having a strongly coupled gauge theory. We don't even start to introduce the gauge field. This is what the core point is. And of course, the problem is that we don't have a small parameter to expand about. But there again, I'm telling you that the FRG ansatz allows you to write down and differential equation approach that is beyond perturbation theory, and then at least has reasonable potential to be applicable to even such a strongly coupled problem.
This is all done in real space?
This is in real space. So the Green's function formalism is real space and frequency.
So the Fermi surface never shows up.
No, so as I think it's a perfectly valid point that you're mentioning, that Tarun also mentioned, what we should continue doing now is definitely investing more time to decompose the two particle vertex that we obtain, not only by contracting it to get some spin-spin correlation function, but also to read off other properties of this effective low energy theory that we obtain. I agree.
2KF is for 2KF purpose of this size.
Yeah,
is but, probably.
Yeah, I have to think more about this. I mean, the core idea for us to start with was that we thought that the competing ordering fluctuations, for example, are of course manifestly perfectly kept, because we can tell you exactly that there are two approaches that had been put forward. One of them had been the 1/n dichromatic approaches, the other one the 1/S. And basically, in this language, this relates to direct particle hole channel and indirect particle hole channel. And all the different channels are kept, plus all vertex corrections. And this is just...
Yes, I have a bit of a follow-up on this word identity. There is something I don't really get.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually you can always write a word identity as a relation between kind of n-leg Green's function and n-1-leg Green's function. So 4 legs to 3 legs or 3 legs to 2 legs, etc.
Yeah.
So your equations seem to have exactly the right form. So it's just a constraint that you would put at each level?
I agree with you. We can talk about this more. We thought about this, and I would really like to talk to you more about this and explain to you what Katanin did. He's exactly elaborating on this point that you're mentioning.
How good is this? With more quantitative, how well can you predict the transition points of these models?
Okay, so
from other sources. So
yeah, let me be a bit phenomenological here. So we looked at the anisotropic triangular lattice, and I think we get very good agreement with other methods there. We looked at the J1, J2, J3 honeycomb model. We get excellent agreement with exact energization, as long as it concerns phase boundaries and many different aspects of the model. We looked at the Heisenberg-Kitaev model, we get agreement with any other approach as far as the other approaches can go. So whatever we could check against other approaches, we found very good correspondence. So by now we believe that in the present version, which probably is not the optimized version of the ansatz, it's just 2 years old, at least we can already produce fairly accurate results.
I'm just curious, in a standard fermionic RG, you in principle not restricted to on-site interaction. So imagine that I would add a Hopping term and we'll try to compare the basically K space or FRG, which is a standard with the Fermi surface and so on, and try to see what comes out if I do just a pure slave fermion approach. Would you have a thought of this? I mean, would it make sense? And what you would expect to see a convergence at some point? Because somehow you argue that if you do this strong coupling RG, it's somehow more or less as a limit of FRG on the fermionic side.
Oh, okay. So people have addressed the question of whether we can include the single particle propagator equation even in recoupling RG. It never really worked for the following reason. that would mean that in their approach, the self-energy that you pile up has an imaginary part and a real part. And the real part will change the Fermi surface. Now, usually it is composed with a momentum cutoff. So when you have a momentum cutoff and your Fermi surface changes at the RG flow, there was never really substantiated, careful treatment of this problem. But I actually agree with you that this can be done and this will be done. I'm pretty sure.
You actually don't have any hopping term.
No, we don't have a hopping.
So the Fermis are always...
The single particle dysfunction is perfectly local.
I was thinking if we, in principle, start to treat it as a perturbation also.
Just to shortly mention that, we need this locality. So you can ask, why has no one done this before some other quantum Hall system of fermions? Let's think about a quantum Hall system. It would be related, right? But the core statement there is what we can employ here is that the single particle Green's function stays local throughout the flow, and that reduces the amount of arguments that we need to consider. So the feasibility at the level of numerics is given by the special properties that the slave Fermion description of frustrated magnets have. So you can't do this for the general fermionic strongly coupled problem. I'm not saying we solve strongly coupled fermionic problems by construction. I'm saying we have a self-consistent resummation approach that has a potential to apply to frustrated magnets.
A quick question. So here you're using a frequency cutoff, right?
Yes.
So can you run temperature flow on those models?
Well, yeah, I mean, essentially that's what we do. I mean, depending on whether you choose a smooth cutoff or a hard cutoff, this essentially ends up either being a Heaviside step function, then it's not exactly temperature, but then
right.
In the end of the day, this is...
So the second question is, if you run the temperature flow, could you compare your results with high temperature expansion, you know, order by order?
So yeah, so that's what we are pursuing at the moment. The first thing that we saw and that we were of course pleased by is that the vertices obey a Curie-Weiss law at high cutoffs. So you explicitly see the temperature behavior manifesting itself in the cutoff behavior in the vertices. So that's the first indication that the cutoff really behaves like a temperature. And there are more details that I could tell you that would further substantiate that statement.